You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scars. I'm joined now by my co-host, Daniel Sperry. Dan, how are you doing on this awesome Thursday afternoon?
I'm doing quite good. It is spring has finally sprung in Kansas City. It is wonderful outside, and it's a good day to get in. There's a lot of good soccer action going on recently, and plenty to talk about.
Absolutely, we had our first real big midweek MLS action, and that was also in the middle of the U.S. Open Cup. The first round proper started now three nights ago. If you're listening to us on Friday, May the 11th, it started on Tuesday. Dan, I got to see FC Denver defeat Azteca FC last night up in Westminster, Colorado, and the winner of that will take on Colorado Springs. But first of all, Dan, you and I also got to see five huge midweek MLS action games. We will start up north as Seattle Sounders got their first big road win of the season, defeating Toronto by the score of 2-1. In a new MLS Cups. Dan, did you get to watch this game? And what did you think about the Sounders kind of pulling a win out of nowhere?
So I didn't get to watch the game. I went back and kind of watched the quick highlights of it. Did some looking at the numbers and whatnot. For me, it just looks like Seattle executed their game plan. They kind of came in with a much better game plan than the last couple times they've played in Toronto. They played up in Toronto, being at both MLS Cups. And I thought they executed it really well. I think they have the pieces that can work to do that. Right now, they don't have a whole lot of good things going for them up front. And so, for them, I think it was a good tactical, quote-unquote, masterpiece from Schmetzer. Because I think they knew the way that Toronto FC would try and come in and play them. And so they wanted to go in and throw in a wrinkle and kind of mess with things. Give Toronto FC a different look than they've probably have had almost all year. I don't believe Toronto have actually played a team with five at the back. So a funky look. They got some pace on the wings that took care of it. A really good finish from Will Bruin. Buana was technically offside the head coach. Goodness. Why is his name escaping me? Toronto FC's head coach. Greg Vanney. In the press conference, took his phone out and showed reporters that the freeze frame that showed Buana offside as that ball was played in. I think it's going to be a little bit of a rough ride for Toronto. I think too many people are going to wrongly count them out. They've got a lot of injury issues going on. They're playing a very makeshift back line. They're playing. There's no Josie Altidore up top to hold up play and run that really good combination that they have between Giovinco. So it's the attack is virtually just Giovinco and the boys, and let's hope something sticks. And then the back line is also kind of a mess. So it all kind of played out really well for Seattle. I still am not entirely convinced that Seattle is that great. This is a rough Toronto team, a team in Toronto that's kind of rough at the moment. But they did a really good job of executing their game plan. They go out, and they played hard, and they fought for 90 minutes and got a win. So an impressive showing from Seattle last night up in Toronto. But it's not the only impressive road win as well.
Absolutely, Dan. We will be getting to Sporting Kansas City, getting the first ever shutout against Atlanta at Mercedes-Benz Arena in a little bit. But I'm going to agree with you, Dan. This game was kind of a little bit of a gut check for the Seattle Sounders. I think they had to have a coming together emotionally after, their really lethargic 0-0 draw against Columbus Crew, after Pedro Santos got a red card in the 15th minute last week. Really just an uninspiring, unimpressive performance on so many levels by the team that I thought they came in here knowing that they had something to prove and they needed to get some kind of result given where they were from a performance standpoint, all the issues that they've got going on offensively and defensively, the issues with the controversy, non-controversy, depending on how you perceive it, from the Garth Lagerwey quotes and Brian Smetzer responding that, and Garth having to do damage control that we talked about a little bit last week, that they just kind of went out there, executed their game plan, and got a result. And look, sometimes you're looking for different pieces to step up. You know, when Dempsey's struggling, Ladero's struggling, Will Bruin's having some issues, nobody's really performing well. And in that case, you know, sometimes it's a random hero in that sense. In this case, it was Handwala Bwana, possibly the best new name in MLS history, as far as I'm concerned. So absolutely fantastic performance from the homegrown in terms of getting the game-winning goal. I agree with you, Dan, that he was offsides. That said, I don't think Seattle really cares at this point. Seattle got 3 points in a game that I don't think they were expecting 3 points, and they got 3 points where I think most Western Conference teams are going to go into BMO Field this season and probably lose. But let's move on to another game in which a Western Conference team got a big road win against an Eastern Conference team. Dan, there was a little bit of controversy in this one. There were lots of opportunities, but unfortunately Atlanta couldn't close it. And Sporting Kansas City are the first team in MLS history to go under Mercedes-Benz and get 3 points against the Red Stripes.
Yeah, it was an incredible match, honestly. Both teams, I think, showed out pretty good. Atlanta started to find their rhythm a little bit. Sporting Kansas City were doing everything they could to get deflections and kind of knock stuff out and make clearances. Of course, there was the one where you had Joseph Martinez, who was ruled offside as Jimmy Madronda did attempt to play the ball but didn't play it correctly, which according to Mark Geiger's interpretation, that does not count as deliberately playing the ball to an opponent. So I feel like the deflection that came off of Jimmy Madronda came when Joseph Martinez was offside. So there's the interpretation there. For me, I will always interpret it that unless the defender deliberately tries to make that pass back, and the offside player who was offside, let's say the ball comes to a defender and he's trying to knock it over to the goalkeeper. But when the ball was played, there's a guy offside behind him, and he plays it back. That guy behind him offside goes and grabs the ball and scores. I think that's what they're, where that, that, what is, at least I can't, I'm blanking on the term, but at least that, that loophole is there, in the offside rule.
Indirect offsides?
Yeah. And to where the problem is that Jimmy Madronda has to make a play on that ball because there are offside people behind him. So if there is no offside people behind him, then there's no reason for him to try and make the play on that ball. And I think that's the point there that was made to the official on that. He doesn't even have to play that if the ball's offside, or if the players off behind him are offside. And usually once the attacker tries to make a play on the ball in an offside position, or forces the defender or someone else to have to make a play, above and beyond the call of duty, on that ball, then the play should be flagged for offside. So I thought Geiger got it right. I also thought he got it right for the most part of the night, which Atlanta fans will vehemently disagree and be some of them even quite nasty about it at times. But that and the Brad Guzan straight red card, it's a straight red card every single time. You should check out Kyrie Shelton's Instagram and you can see the giant the shred marks from Brad Guzan's cleat down the inside of his calf. Straight red, easy call. Sporting Kansas City get the 2-0 win. Great goal from Daniel Shallowy. I thought this game probably was going to be more set for like a 1-1 game or maybe a 2-1 Atlanta win before the red card, but the red card certainly changed it. The problem is you could point to the red card if it wasn't a deserved red card, but it was a clear and deserved red card, and you just can't point to those as things that truly affect an outcome, because you can't do that. You just can't swing your foot at someone who's running by you and rake your cleat down their calf as they're clear and on goal. So, that's going to be a red card every single time. So, that's that challenge itself changed the game, as it could have been 1-0 Sporting Kansas City. So I thought the result was deserved for Sporting Kansas City in the end. A lot of things going back and forth here. I do think, unfortunately, the red card did rob us what could have been a crazy 90-minute game between the two. But, you know, it still was a really, really good match. Tim Melia had to make a bunch of amazing saves. And now Sporting Kansas City are sitting atop the Supporters' Shield standings already after 11 games. So, you know, this is a big win for Sporting Kansas City. And I think a big win for the Western Conference too, to go in and get a win down in Atlanta, especially a shutout against such a high-powered offense in Atlanta United.
Absolutely, Dan. I'll have to admit that I missed. I was getting ready to head out for the U.S. Open Cup game for FC Denver at the time that the red card had actually happened to Brad Guzan, so I can't speak to that. But based on everything I've seen of it, I agree that it is a red card. I also agree with you that I think, you know, the red card, while I think deserved to Brad Guzan, kind of, I would say it almost spoiled us of potentially a game of the year candidate in terms of both of these two teams, the style of plays that they play, just the tactical intricacies you're going to have. Bobby Warsaw wrote a really, really great piece on MLSsoccer.com earlier this week about the rotations and how they've gotten Graham Zusi involved a little bit more in the attack centrally, that I thought was really, really fascinating. And I was really curious to see how that was going to work as opposed to Atlanta sort of overloading with some of their tiki-taka style of play as well. And we were robbed of, you know, that for the better part of 60 minutes with Brad Guzan's red card. That said, good on Sporting Kansas City for taking advantage of that situation. So, you know, in that sense, I think it was a little bit of a disappointment, but I agree with you. Absolutely solid win for Sporting Kansas City. And I know there's kind of been a discussion the last couple weeks in MLS of it being basically New York City, Atlanta, once Toronto figures it out, and then basically everybody else saying that, you know, Sporting Kansas City was leaps and bounds behind all of them. And I think this is a certainly big win that I think I agree with you gives the Western Conference a little bit more credibility. And I think certainly has Sporting Kansas City in that conversation. I still don't think that they're on paper overall, even when completely healthy, that they're better than Atlanta or New York City, but they're at the table in ways in which I think pundits, you know, a week ago, 2 weeks ago would not have had them in that conversation. Just a couple other results from you on Wednesday night, folks. Columbus Crew get a 1-0 win against the Philadelphia Union. Giassi Zardes with an unassisted goal. He continues to outscore Ola Kamara and the vast majority of the LA Galaxy forward core. Chicago Fire finally get a win at home, an absolute screecher at the death from Kevin Ellis. Dan, we're going to laugh about Kevin Ellis having more goals than some of the Sporting forwards a little bit. And then a fairly straightforward result, LAFC going 2-0 up on Minnesota United. Some great play from Carlos Vela and Diego Rossi. Dan, what's some of your big takeaways from sort of those other three games? Anything that surprised you? And you want to talk about Kevin Ellis just, you know, trying to stick it to Peter Vermes and company?
I don't know if he's necessarily trying to stick it to Peter Vermes and company, but man, I'm surprised Sporting Kansas City didn't try him out at striker after the two goals he scored in the last two games. You had the screamer of the volley over the weekend for the late goal for Chicago. Then he cuts back in onto his left and rips one into the near post. It's funny, I pointed it out on Twitter last night. Kevin Ellis has more goals with two this year than all of Sporting Kansas City's number nine, quote-unquote, strikers. They would consider all three of them a forward group because they rotate so much. But the pure number nine type position, there's only one goal that's come out of that, and that's been Diego Rubio as the late equalizer in Colorado. So Kevin Ellis has more goals than Sporting KC strikers, and Sporting Kansas City sent him on his way to Chicago. So interesting there. The big takeaway for me for this, though, is one, I did like LAFC getting a sound win against a Minnesota United team that's actually looked a lot better in recent weeks. But I look at Minnesota United, I know they lost, and they're playing against a really high-powered opponent in LAFC, who's right now clearly the second best team in the Western Conference for me. I actually was impressed with their performance, and they had a couple of really good chances late throughout that game. And I think things are going to come together from them. And this is a team that I believe is better than their record shows. The problem is that their record is their record. And at some point you have to account for that. But I do think that this is a team that, you know, going forward as they slowly integrate guys like Darwin Quintero, and a few of their other new signings, and really incorporating, seems like they've incorporated Miguel Ibarra much more into the attack this year. I'd like to see more of Mason Toy up front, as there's been a lot of really good plaudits from his play and development coming out of the Minnesota media group. So, you know, I'd like, even though they lost 2-0, it's a hard result to go down there and get a result at LAFC, especially with how well that they're playing and how good of a team they are. But I do think Minnesota is actually showing that I actually think they could really compete for a lower spot in the playoffs, at least at the 5 or 6 spot in the Western Conference. And I think time will show. But even going into LAFC and not getting trounced 6-0 shows that this is a much better Minnesota United team than we've seen in the past. So that's another one for me. Also, Chicago's been able to grind stuff out here and there lately, and that's really intriguing to me as well. I would like to see how their attack looked really good last night against Montreal. And for me, for Montreal, it was so weird for them to look so good over the weekend against what had been a good New England team, and then to go into Chicago and put in the type of performance they did. Really, Chicago probably could have won that game 3 or 4-0. If you go back and look at some of the highlights and look at some of the chances that Chicago missed. So, you know, they certainly had their chances to make that a 3 or 4-0 win. So, you know, I don't know how, honestly, really my takeaway from those two is I don't know how to read either team, because one will go out and get a shock win, then they'll go out and play terrible the next game. And, you know, I just don't know what to do with Montreal and Chicago right now. And I still don't know what version of which team we're actually going to get in the long run. So a lot of interesting things, though, but I think Minnesota is a much better team than people would give them credit for, despite their loss down in LA this weekend.
I am definitely buying some Mo Adams stock right now. To your point, Dan, I thought Chicago was definitely a much more impressive team than we've seen from them. And I thought Mo Adams was a big part of keeping Nacho Piatti in absolute check. I agree with you that I feel like I wrote an article a couple weeks ago now basically saying that the Western Conference was like the Wild West. It was basically Sporting Kansas City's really good and everybody else is an unknown quantity or trying to figure it out or has some distinct really good quality and then something else that they don't do really well. And I would kind of lump Montreal and Chicago into that category right now in the sense that I'm not entirely sure what they are. We know what Montreal is from a defensive standpoint and what they're going to do offensively with Nacho Piatti. I don't know that they have a whole lot of pieces around him in order to be competitive in a stacked Eastern Conference. And as we've talked about and everybody's kind of been talking about in MLS circles, you know, Chicago Fire did a bunch of really good stuff on and off the field last year, and then they basically decided to hold pat and everybody else in the Eastern Conference got better. I'm still not entirely sure what either of these teams are from a quality standpoint, and I'm not sure what I'm going to get out of any of them, but Chicago showed up when they needed to and they got 3 points against a team that I think most of the top teams of the Eastern Conference are going to beat at home in Montreal. So props to them. Albeit against a weak opponent, you know, props to Columbus Crew of kind of getting off the snide. They've kind of had a rough run of form in terms of goal scoring and hitting a couple of posts and everything. So good on them for getting 3 points and good on Giassi Zardes for continuing to score and prove Greg Berhalter's support and belief coming true. I'm going to agree with you also, Dan, on LAFC's performance and just how much they needed that win, just from not only winning by multiple goals, but also just having the performance they did. I agree with you, Minnesota might not be as bad as the record has shown, but you look at LAFC, you know, they get the win on the apps, you know, they get back-to-back wins off, you know, late free kicks by Lorenz Simon that were basically right at the death that really shouldn't have been wins for them. And they kind of have a really, to me at least, a relatively meh draw against FC Dallas. So, you know, you have a game where you could argue that the Sounders outplayed them for, you know, 89 minutes or, you know, 90 minutes plus 2 minutes of stoppage time. And then Stefan Fry bobbles a free kick that gets you a win to open the stadium. Then you have a little bit of of a lackluster, not super exciting draw against FC Dallas, who makes the game a little bit mucky and not really consistent and free flowing, then, you know, finally you're able to get, you know, a solid win, a solid performance against a team you should beat at home. So I thought that was good in terms of Bob Bradley's team getting a little bit of confidence and creating a little bit more buzz with their new stadium opening and having that atmosphere result in points, so to speak. That's it as far as all of our midweek MLS recap stuff. Dan, I'm going to give you the last word on this segment. Any closing thoughts, or shall we head to break?
I'll say we'll head to break.
Okay, listeners, we will be right back going full off script, talking about all the MLS players. It's going to be mind-boggling and possibly migraine-inducing. We'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners, to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, Last Word on Soccer.com. I'm joined once again by Daniel Sperry. Dan, today the MLS gods gave us a mighty present right before we were going to start recording, and that was releasing all of the MLS player salaries for 2018 from the MLS Players Union. How excited are you to get totally nerdy about all of the math and all of the MLS roster rules and money financial regulations?
I am totally down for it. One, I feel like I'm pretty well versed in the roster rules now, as I've like dove into them hardcore the last couple of seasons to figure some things out. Supporting Kansas City do whatever they can to take advantage of that stuff, and so you kind of, if you're trying to understand some of the moves that they do, you got to pour yourself into all of the loopholes, because for me, he finds all the loopholes somehow. But yeah, and also Sporting Kansas City don't have a game this weekend for me to cover, so I'm really happy that I have something to write about and something to kind of keep me in tune to them this weekend. Otherwise, baseball could potentially take over. So no, I'm any time that the salaries get released, it's a good thing and it's a good day. So I'm excited about that. I'm glad that these came out. It's a gift. It's a spring gift for us.
Absolutely. Listeners, check out Dan's musings on Peter Vermees and all of his workings of the Sporting Kansas City salary budget at lastwordonsoccer.com. But for now, Dan, let's get into it. For the third straight year, I believe, in a row, Sebastian Giovinco is the highest paid player in MLS. He has a total compensation of just over $7.1 million. There's a little bit of a terminology change here, Dan, that I think is the same. Previous iterations of this document were referring to it as base salary, which is just the absolute base minimum that they're getting, and then total compensation in past iterations has been guaranteed compensation in the form of some performance-based initiatives that were instigated from either previous seasons or the current season, and then also players can get compensated for player appearances, other sponsorship stuff, and there's a little bit of ambiguity as to which number the league goes by when it comes to what's actually counting against the salary cap. But in any case, Giovinco's there at the max. Other guys who are at the top of the list here, folks, Michael Bradley and Josie Altidore, of course, Sebastian Giovinco, Bastian Schweinsteiger, David Villa's up there. Dan, we were talking a little bit before we pressed record that I was a little bit surprised that Ignacio Piatti is the highest paid member of the Montreal Impact at $4.7 million U.S. dollars. All of these numbers are in USD for any of you who are listening in Canada. But then his guaranteed base salary is just over $500,000. It's actually $500,000.04. I always find it funny that MLS provides the cent totals and all this stuff. So more than eight ninths of Nacho Piatti's 2018 total compensation is not from his base salary, which makes me wonder, like, what other sponsorship does he have going on? Like, is somebody paying in poutine? But in any case, there's that. you guys can see all the total roster rules and regulations and everything over on MLSsoccer.com. For those of you wondering the minimum base salary, there's a bunch of players who are getting paid the $54,000 the $54,500 and around 4 cents in most cases. I believe the bottom of those two are Jesus Ferreira, thank you. From FC Dallas, and also Nuhu Tolo from Seattle Sounders FC. And there's a bunch of players who I guess are just behind them making 4 cents more from a bunch of different teams. That is the I believe the reserve salary league minimum, which is slightly less than the senior minimum. But in any case, Dan, you're looking over some of these salary amounts. What jumps out to you from just an overall standpoint? And why don't you give us a lowdown on what you've seen so far from looking at Sporting Kansas City and the Quakes?
So, I actually haven't dug in a whole lot to everyone else's everyone else's salary here, but you know, I think it's just interesting how, I mean, how much that these numbers have gone up a lot over the last couple of years. I mean, you look at Toronto FC's average salary is $900,000. That's a lot, and you know, I granted they've got a couple guys that are making, you know, above $4 or $5 million, but at the same time, you know, that's it. They've got a lot of other expensive pieces up through the roster. It's also kind of fun, and I know as you were dealing with in your article, and looking at how much teams are spending, what their salary total is, and I think one thing to look, good thing to look at is their salary total, and then their what their average salary is, and then what their median salary is, and then you can really get a good idea of where the, if you see a large discrepancy, I think in those, then I'd like to I would like to see, so like let's say someone is up at the top of the total salary structure, and the average salary is up there, but if you go back down to their median salary, shows that they might be using a lot of TAM to buy a lot of contracts down if there's a big difference between the average salary and the median salary. At least that's how I was interpreting it. And then if you look at, you know, how much overall salary they've got, you can kind of check and see, you know, check, is your team spending on discretionary TAM or not? You kind of have that question there. So a lot of good stuff in here, a lot of good nuggets. I think the most interesting thing looking at Sporting Kansas City, though, and their salaries is one, for a salary that I thought would be a little bit higher, as I know San Jose Earthquakes like to give their homegrown contract guys like close to $100,000, especially the older ones, ones coming out of college. And you have Daniel Shalloway only making $65,000, which at 21 years old is super nice, but like $65,000 for someone who is playing at the level that he is really intriguing. So that was another one to look at. Gianluca Busio, who was Sporting Kansas City's youngest signing ever, is actually making more than him technically. Although the base salary is different, Gianluca Busio is making $82,504, while Daniel Shalloway is making $81,625 in total compensation, but the base salary is about $13,000 higher in favor of Gianluca Busio, who is just barely 16 years old. So that's really fun to look at those kind of numbers, and I'm wondering where the heck he's stockpiling that money, or if he's bought a car yet or something like that, because he can actually just now drive. So fun stuff there. But yeah, I think it's just interesting to me to look at kind of where Sporting Kansas City has spread out their salary, and they clearly have been paying guys that have come up and give them good performances, and that they're expecting a lot out of that type of money. And it'll be interesting to see when guys like Daniel Shalloway, who's, you know, like I said, is making $81,000, and Jimmy Madronda, who is they're starting left back now and has been really, really good this year. Kind of a Swiss Army knife, does all for them. He's a guy that I think when he's not in the lineup, they miss a lot. And he's only making $140,000. And there's no difference between his total compensation or base salary. So that's an interesting thing looking at Sporting Kansas City. They've also definitely upped their spending a bit. They have not gotten the only DP contract, DP level contract that they got rid of from 2017. Well, they had two technically, in Dwyer and Benny Failhaber, but both of those have been replaced with salaries equal or higher than what they are, than what Dwyer and Failhaber's salaries were. They've actually added an extra $1 million to their total payroll. So I think it's interesting to see Sporting Kansas City definitely spending a lot more. The way they've been talking recently, it sounds like they've got a lot more capital than they did, let's say, 3 or 4 years ago, and they're really willing to spend it. I don't think they'll ever be at that level of the Toronto FC, like spending $26 million. But I do think on a roster, but they are spending about $9 million now. And I could see them in the next few years maybe even touching close to the $12 or $13 million range. if they really want to get out there and breed out like a whole roster top to bottom that is just incredibly competitive and talented. That's what they've kind of tried to do, I think, in some of their roster building moves, and they're still working on it. And a quick note, as so I don't drown on and on here, on the San Jose Earthquake side of things, one is they promised that they were going to be in the top half of the league in spending, and they were going to spend and try and and get themselves up that way. But they really only have they have a couple people that are making over $500,000 in their base salary, and there's very few. It is Chris Wondolowski. It is who's making $800,000 a year, and then there's Vako Kazayashvili, who's making $1.3 million in their base salary, and a lot of other guys are kind of sitting down around that $400,000-$500,000 mark. But there's not a lot, honestly, on those guys who are making a whole lot of money. And Magnus Harrison is actually below the designated player threshold. They signed him as a DP, so apparently the transfer fee that they had to pay to get him is that that made him the designated player. So that was an interesting thing to find out there. Florian Jungwirth is making $500,000, but you know, this is a team that promised that they'd actually be in total spending on their roster, that they would be towards the top, and they are at least in the top half of the league. And really, they're only spending $7.7 million on their roster, which is now good for 18th out of 23 teams in MLS. So it's interesting as they move forward in their progression and what they're trying to do and their promises to fans and stuff like that, and how much they're gonna spend on the team and make this team good. I don't entirely see that actually coming to fruition, and I don't know if they're spending to keep up with that. You know, we're going to be in the top half of the league in spending promise that they made. So interesting note there. On the Earthquakes, they're more down to the bottom, where last year they were 10th overall in player salary. So, you know, it shows a lot of the teams at the top of this are playoff teams, outside of, save, you know, LA Galaxy and the Chicago, and I wouldn't even say Chicago Fire, they're a playoff team last year. But Montreal spends a lot of money, weren't in the playoffs last year. Colorado is now spending a lot of money, but I think that was due to a ton of influx in capital this year. So, you know, I think if the Earthquakes want to be up in that, they either are going to have to go the model of the New York Red Bulls and spend big on a few players here and there and develop a whole lot internally, but their academy hasn't really shown the ambition to develop internally and show a path to the pro level through San Jose Earthquakes. So that's not going to sustain themselves. If they're not going to spend on the senior roster and they're not going to invest in the youth academy, then what the heck are they doing? They're just sitting in the middle and, you know, being okay with mediocre soccer. I don't know. But I'm sure, and my own reaction as an Earthquakes fan, and I know plenty of other Earthquakes fans, and their reaction on what has come out of these numbers being released has definitely been on the negative side, just given what the promises were made by the San Jose front office to the Quakes fans and what's actually taking place.
Really good insight there, Dan. Just a few other tidbits that I noticed overall from the league. For all we talked about, Ezequiel Barco, you know, being a record transfer fee into the league, you know, reportedly $15 million. He's only making just over $1.5 million in terms of total compensation, that I think is interesting. Now, maybe there's a lot of performance incentives that are going to come in there, or maybe things change, you know, post Miguel Marón or Joseph Martinez leaving. But in any case, I always find it interesting when people make a big deal out of a player, either because of a salary or a transfer fee or what's perceived, and then those two don't necessarily line up, or they're not proportional in terms of the hype and the expectation. Not saying that I'm thinking or expecting less of Barco because he's only making $1.4 million. He is really, really young, but just really interesting to see that. And then a few other players got a pretty decent raise. There was a lot of speculation in terms of how much Minnesota was going to spend on Darwin Quintero. He's at just over $1.5 million, I think $1.65 million. And then Dax McCarty, you know, Little Red there got up in Chicago, got a nice little raise. He's at $700,000. You know, I'd put that, you know, off the top of my head as probably the highest paid number six in the league. I think it's deserved in terms of his performance. But, you know, as I've kind of alluded to through various channels, I still think that, you know, number sixes are really easy to find in really good quality in MLS and just in America in general, that I don't know that it's worth overpaying for some of them. You know, maybe there's a lot that Dax McCarty he's doing off the field that's coming into that, or maybe those were due to performance triggers that Frummy did last season, in which case good on him, but I find that interesting. And then Christian Ramirez almost got a raise twofold. In 2017, he was making just under $400,000, and he's now making just under $650,000. I'm assuming most of that is performance incentives just because he scored a boatload of goals as an American last year. I just also find it interesting that, you know, Adrian Heath seems to like Abu Dhanladi and a few other options. And, you know, reportedly, you know, there was a League MX offer that the Loons turned down for $1.5 million in a transfer fee for him last year. So good on him in terms of performing really well in 2017 and then getting his pay, given that the team isn't winning a whole lot. But that's a whole chunk the salary that if you're not going to get something out of, might as well try and move that and get something else. So I just find all of those really interesting. As Dan alluded to, I wrote a pretty lengthy article for Last Word on Soccer about the Colorado Rapids situation. There's a lot of speculation, especially among the Rapids fan base, in terms of how much TAM the Rapids were going to be using, just because I think some fans would describe the Kroenke Sports Entertainment, or just the Rapids in general, as being, you know, relatively cheap when it comes to it. I go through the whole calculations, but in short, I think they're spending a lot more than I think we thought they were spending. And I think they're spending money in areas where we didn't necessarily think they were on some of the hype of some of the players that we got. I also think the Rapids have a number of really, really good quality budget players. For all the hype that was brought in terms of the team using TAM to acquire Jack Price and supposedly a pretty decent transfer fee, he's only making just over $400,000 in terms of guaranteed compensation USD. So I think that's a pretty decent haul. As I mentioned, you know, Dax McCarty's getting a whole lot of money, but in terms of bringing in a foreign regista, I think that's a pretty nice salary for Jack Price and certainly a good value in terms of the budget cap that he's hitting. And then Edgar Castillo making just under $130,000 for the Colorado Rapids, I think is an absolute steal, given that he was one of the better veteran outside backs in Liga MX to come in like that. No TAM, no GAM, no DP slot for him on the one-year loan for him, I thought was a really, really good deal. And then Enzo El Vikingo Martinez is on a league minimum contract. Martinez was a MVP candidate and a best 11 player the last 2 years in USL for Charlotte Independence, and I thought he's been a real monster in terms of being an engine in the midfield. To get him on, you know, a senior minimum contract is really good. On the LA Galaxy side of things, not so many good stuff, Dan. Feel free to laugh at me throughout the process of saying this. Of course, we can't start with the Galaxy in terms of non-productivity without talking about Giovanni Dos Santos, who has a guaranteed compensation of $6 million this year. That's, you know, top 10 in the league easily. And just over the course of the last 2 weeks, he scored his first two goals in almost a calendar year for both club and country. And then Jonah Dos Santos, surprisingly, Dan, is only making around $2 million in terms of guaranteed compensation. I find that kind of interesting, given how much the Dos Santos brothers really wanted to play together. I would have thought they would have been similar in salary. Granted, they play slightly different roles. Gio was here first. There was a big transfer fee in order to get him. Jonah came over on a free because he was out of contract with Villarreal. So, you know, I from a financial standpoint, you know, if I were running the Galaxy on FIFA Manager or, you know, on FIFA, on Football Manager or FIFA in Manager mode, I probably would have brought these two players in for a similar salary. You know, I certainly would have taken both at like 3.5 as opposed to 1 at 6 and 1 at 2. But in any case, there's that. Of course, Lockton is making the much reported $1.5 million, pretty much all on TAM. Jorgen Selvik, who has not been impressive in my eyes, is the highest paid defender Major League Soccer this year. Total compensation right at $1 million. He is the only defender in all of Major League Soccer who is at seven figures. He has been not really impressive for me at all. And then Ashley Cole almost getting a double in terms of his total compensation. He was making right around 350K the last couple years for the LA Galaxy. He's now at almost $730,000 in terms of total compensation. Not sure how much of that is TAM or GAM or performance incentives, but you know, for a 36-year-old left back, as much as he means to the Galaxy in terms of leadership, being their captain and everything, you know, I still think that's kind of overpriced. And then, you know, a lot of really good value pieces. You know, we can talk about all the homegrowns and the Generation Adidas deals that, of course, the Galaxy love to take advantage of. And then João Pedro, who came into the Galaxy, and he was a TAM player because of the transfer fee, reportedly $1.5 million spent on him. His guaranteed compensation, Dan, just over $175,000. And because, or yes, $241,000. I was looking at the wrong row. He's actually down with LA Galaxy 2 right now, Dan, because the Galaxy do not have enough international roster spots, and he was the easiest one to move down because the Galaxy also has and misses Servando Carrasco, who is married to not Kristen Press. Alex Morgan, excuse me, Mr. Alex Morgan. And so that's kind of embarrassing from the standpoint of you spent a transfer fee on this guy. He had kind of a rough 2017. Granted, he had to play next to Jermaine Jones. You're paying him $250,000 and you're putting him on your USL team because of a mechanism in the league in which he is the most expendable international player that you have on your squad. And you've got two players making close to the league veteran minimum, who are both Americans, who you think could do a better job from him. So, you know, I said all along the LA Galaxy is a great accumulation of talent, a great accumulation of star profile and big money, but still just looks like a bunch of jigsaw pieces that are from a bunch of different jigsaw puzzles. And right now that kind of seems to make sense in terms of them being inefficient in terms of money spent to results on the field. Okay, Dan, let's go to some brief pick-ems to close out this segment. Just very briefly, looking at the roster spots, who do you see right now who sticks out to you in terms of good value or just a salary that really surprises you from a player being maybe way overcompensated or way undercompensated?
That's a hard one. I actually think it's sad because Kevin Molino is out, but Kevin Molino at only $400,000, which is technically over the DP threshold, but you know, 25,000 TAM doesn't hurt to knock him down underneath that threshold or however low that they want to. It's a minimal amount, considering the amount of discretionary TAM that is available to these guys. When he is healthy and going, he is a great playmaker and is able to string a whole lot of things together. I also think Ibsen at Minnesota United is a great steal at only $300,000. He's a pretty darn good number six. But for me, if you're going to look at anything that is a true, at least the franchise that's that's known for creating these good quote unquote steals, is Artur, who is easily one of the best number sixes and one of the best midfielders in the league, is only making $210,000. That's a fantastic midfield addition to have at that level. And for me, I think that's easily one of the better steals because it's the number six position and the defensive midfield position is so crucial if you have players who are good at it and can distribute really well out of it. And Artur is one of those players. And Columbus Crew FC fought hard to keep him around. They're only paying him $210,000. And that's a freaking steal for this franchise. And for a franchise that likes to operate at a quote-unquote minimum, for me, I look at that and that is probably one of the steals in MLS to have a midfielder of that quality only sitting there at $200,000.
Absolutely, Dan. In terms of steals for me, this is maybe a little because he's an easy name because of him being rookie of the year last year. But Julian Gressel from Atlanta United, Dan, is only making just over $111,000. And a good chunk of that money, I believe he is Generation Adidas. So a good chunk of that money is on his rookie deal from Generation Adidas. So not even all of that $111,000 is counting against Atlanta United's cap. Really good deal. I could go off and list a number of homegrowns. They're really good just because of the league incentives you have there. I feel like, you know, in that sense, I could list like, you know, a quarter of the New York Red Bulls roster right now in terms of being efficient in terms of their money spent. And then, you know, Tim Parker, who as far as American center backs is concerned, could easily be making 200 plus, is, you know, guaranteed compensation of only 116,000. There's a lot of really good value Americans here and really good value young players who either due to their performances or due to the contract incentives that the league has put in order to try and get teams to invest in youth development has been really, really easy to find value in terms of some of these players, in terms of how much they can be compensated versus how much they're actually counting against the team purse strings. In terms of, you know, highly overpaid players, you know, again, some of these are coming off of players who do a lot of really good stuff off the field but aren't necessarily productive on the field. Mentioned Giovanni Dos Santos a little bit earlier. Dan, we're both kind of laughing. You know, MLS, because of single entity, will have teams release players, but then also they still count against the overall, they still count against the league, and the league essentially has to pick up the salary. I remember last year, you might remember this, Dan, Jack McInerney was released by the Portland Timbers, was making just over $300,000, and the LA Galaxy picked him off on a flyer. But the condition that the Galaxy had with the league was, we're only playing him the base minimum salary. So the Galaxy were only having to pay him the $67,500, and the other $250,000+ was having to come straight out of the league. And so on that note, Yurimov Sisian, formerly of Real Salt Lake, because MLS single entity and the franchise system, the league is shelling out almost $2.1 million to Yurimov Sisian to essentially exist, with nobody picking him up, nobody foreign wanting to pick him up and put him on contract. And he essentially just gets paid that because at one point RSL decided to pay him that, but then now RSL didn't want him anymore, and the league has to pick up for something that was ultimately a bad business decision, or MLS, or the club trying to move on from that. Something that's really funny and kind of sad as far as single entity is concerned, that I'd really love in the next CBA the league to take the training wheels off of, so that the league and other teams essentially aren't having to shell out to pay for a player because of a mistake a team made, so to speak. Dan, any other things that we're missing as far as MLS player salaries, or, you know, stuff that's coming to light in the last 24 hours, or shall we head to break?
I actually didn't name a player that I thought was getting overpaid, so I'm going to give you three of them real quick. One, Giovanni Dos Santos, duh, that's a pretty simple one. Another one happens to be Tim Howard. $2 million is by far the highest paid goalkeeper in the league. Almost, what is it? I think the next highest is Brad Guzan at $650,000. So apparently Tim Howard is $1.4 million better, or worth more that much in the Rapids' eyes. And frankly, I think Zach McMath's a better keeper than Tim Howard right now anyways. And he's making just a fraction of that $2 million. And then I have to look at another one here. A goalkeeper that you're very familiar with. Former LA Galaxy goalkeeper, who's now with the Vancouver Whitecaps, Brian Rowe, is not very good at all. And for me, I sit there and I look at how much he's making. He's making $135,000. They're paying a very bad goalkeeper a lot of money to be a backup. As they also technically have four goalkeepers on the roster, and certainly, in my opinion, Spencer Rishi is probably just about as good, if not better, than Brian Rowe at almost $90,000 cheaper. So I think that as a lot of times, some of the smaller amounts will get overlooked, just because of how, you know, okay, we're looking at somebody who's not scoring, not doing anything. They're making X amount of money. Fine, whatever. But for me, sometimes there's a lot of guys that are head scratchers too, that are down there that are making a whole lot of money compared to their actual worth within the roster. And then I'll throw out one more Whitecaps player that I think is significantly overpaid on a roster that seems like it's full of significantly overpaid players, is that of Breck Shea, making $700,000. That is ridiculous. Maybe $300,000, sure. But you're essentially paying a left back / winger / we don't know what position he plays, $745,000 to be above mediocre. And, you know, I look up and down this Whitecaps
roster. A bench man bun.
Basically. And there, I look up and down this Whitecaps roster, and there just overspends everywhere, and it is pretty bad. So that's my quick overspendings that I thought was a whole lot. Overall, I mean, I just like how much the league spending has trended upwards. Because I go back a few years ago, remember what at Toronto FC or somebody was anybody coming close to $10 million on their entire budget seemed like a heck of a lot of money being spent on a roster. And now, if you're not spending $10 million on your roster, you better be spending smartly. And those who are spending over it, some of them aren't spending very smartly. So that's really intriguing overall to look at these roster numbers and kind of see where, the different styles of getting it done. As the numbers overall have jumped, the different styles of getting it done are quite intriguing, with teams like New York Red Bulls and Columbus down at the bottom of it, and then you have TSC at the top of it, who are spending the most and they're winning the most. So, and then you have the Galaxy just underneath them, who are spending the second most and not winning the second most. So it's just interesting to see how the league has kind of evolved in terms of an efficiency standpoint, in terms of spending, and in terms of, where the overall capital head is at with this league.
Absolutely, Dan. And since you wanted to laugh at, former LA Galaxy goalkeepers in terms of how much they're getting paid, you mentioned Brian Rowe being awful. Let's talk about Clément Diop. Montreal Impact guaranteed total compensation, $97,290. And that's USD. Convert that to Canada, and that looks even better. Listeners, we'll be right back in the roundtable. Welcome back, listeners, to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports, the Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scarves. It's time for the roundtable, and first of all, Dan, we have another crazy rumor involving DC United and a European star potentially coming over as a designated player. There's been a whole bunch of hoopla, listeners, in the last 48 hours about Wayne Rooney supposedly telling Everson that he wants to join DC United, potentially the two parties getting involved, talking about a potential transfer fee, what his potential salary looks like, and a whole bunch of other things. This is just another crazy wormhole for us to go down as DC United continues to try to spark the attack and also bring a quality international star both on and off the field to help them feel Audi Field and maybe get a little bit more buzz around the team and move away from Benny Ball folks. The reports that we're getting is this is in the multi-millions of pounds, I believe, Dan. That we have potentially involved with Everton and DC United. Looking at that, Wayne Rooney is 32 years old, folks. He is actively balding, and if the rumors are believed, he has not been laying off the cigars or the beers in terms of his time as Everton. Dan, I'm not sure how I feel about this one. I think Rooney will certainly put butts in seats. I think he'll definitely sell jerseys and everything. I'm just not sure where he fits in to the DC United attack, just because I think he's going to be a central playmaker. And then, Ariola is clearly on 1 week. You've got Yamil Assad on the other. What does this do in terms of the Luciano Acosta role, so to speak? And, for this much money that they're going to have to spend in salary, in guaranteed compensation, and a transfer fee for Wayne Rooney, I feel like they get three or four guys who maybe no DC United supporter has ever heard of, but also could be equally in terms of contributing and helping this team get back into the playoffs. What do you make of this potential Euro retread potentially coming over to Major League Soccer?
So I think it is one, and if we're going to just look at it, I don't know if Wayne Rooney has the legs left. This is a pretty physical, fast league. We've seen that the aging guys that come over from the Premier League, just if they can't keep up with the speed in the Premier League, they're probably not going to keep up with the speed here. The only question of speed in this game in the United States is that of the ball movement. Right now, the players move faster than the ball does. And so that is where a lot of the speed of the game is focused on, is when the players have the ball and are running at players, not necessarily the speed of the ball movement. I don't think that helps Wayne Rooney any bit. But here's the thing. I think if so, we're looking at it from a soccer standpoint, I don't think Wayne Rooney's going to fit very well. He, from a league's marketing standpoint, love it. Absolutely love it. He's a big name, European household, or European name that can be a household name if you pay enough attention to sports, or at least remotely have entertained the thought of paying attention to European soccer before. And Manchester United, especially in the early 2010s, I am sure you have paid attention or somehow heard of Wayne Rooney at some point. So, you know, there, I think it's a good move in terms of the draw that Wayne Rooney will have. And in terms of the entertainment that it'll bring, both good and or bad from Rooney. And so the only thing left to say is, like, I'm happy it's not. I love Wayne Rooney as a big Manchester United guy, great legacy with that team, but I'm sure as heck happy it is not my team in MLS that is taking the flyer on Wayne Rooney, so I can enjoy what I believe could be a potential train wreck from a distance.
Could not agree more with you on that front, Dan. Moving on, we've got a whole bunch of European. There's a whole bunch of hoopla out there right now, Dan, that you're all going to talk about. We talked about on the show the ongoing saga of Chicago Fire potentially interested in Fernando Torres, with the I call it the spring transfer window for MLS being over. Now all of these moves are looking to be what's going to happen as soon as the summer transfer window opens in the middle of July, folks. So Fernando Torres, Chicago Fire, you know, potentially still trying to work on that. There's Ener Valencia. There's still Mario Balotelli, who's been linked with DC United, potentially a whole bunch of others. And Bobby Wood, who still, you know, despite the finances, could be looking to come back to MLS. Dan, what can you tell us on what's the latest, and what do you think about all of this nonsense?
So Fernando Torres has rumored, well, there was rumored that there he was talking with the Chicago Fire, and that the Nelson Rodriguez, the GM for the Chicago Fire, was working hard to bring him in, but he actually said that he didn't feel like he felt it was too cold and he wanted some warmer weather. And then of course the weird face or Twitter rumor that broke the other day was that he had come to an agreement with Montreal. Warm weather doesn't equate. Feel like Montreal is colder than Chicago. Interesting. I know Houston's still in the mix. I think Sporting Kansas City had said they were interested, but I don't really think he just doesn't fit the type of player that Sporting Kansas City has bought and Peter Ramiz have bought in the recent years. So I'm a no-go on Fernando Torres for them, but I sure would like to see El Nino in the league. I think it'd be interesting. Find a team that needs a striker that badly. I think he would do better there, but a team that's looking to play quickly or something like that, I don't know. But a bunch of Euro retreads up in Chicago kind of sounds interesting, as long as Nelson Rodriguez can kind of fix it. Convince him, despite the cold weather in Chicago. Then you have Ener Valencia from Tigres, who's kind of fallen out of favor there after the first time. His first go around with them was, you know, team of the season bound. After coming over from West Ham and Everton, where he had had deals done, and then he comes back. To Liga MX, he does okay. His better years are behind. His more goal scoring years came from his time at Puebla, which is after he took off in the 2014 World Cup and his stock took off then. Looking, there's rumors that he's interested in coming to MLS. For me, a team 100% that should jump in on that one is actually Sporting Kansas City. I feel like as a defensive forward, which is what he is, he'd be the perfect fit. He's kind of a big, stocky dude. He's got pace. He can score. I think he'd be a good signing for Sporting Kansas City and Peter Ramiz if they're really trying to look and solidify and get an elite player up at that front nine. I think he'd be a better option than Kyrie Shelton. As much as I do like what Kyrie Shelton has brought to this team, I still think Valencia would be just as good, if not better, up there. And so I think it's a move that Sporting Kansas City should take a look at, but there are definitely other teams that are probably looking at him. And then you have Mario Balotelli, as you said, or Mario Balotelli, who, as you had said, and I still don't see this one coming. Although that would be the most entertaining thing that MLS could ever hope for, is to get Mario Balotelli in here. And then, of course, the Bobby Wood rumors stay kind of as they are. The latest on the Bobby Wood rumor is that if Hamburg get relegated from the Bundesliga, that he will head to Huddersfield to play with American/German manager David Wagner, as Huddersfield have clinched their season atop, or at least clinched another year in the Premier League after being promoted last year. So Bobby Wood to Huddersfield is probably the more likely thing than Bobby Wood to MLS. So we can kind of count out Bobby Wood, kind of count out Mario Balotelli coming to the league. But Fernando Torres, Enner Valencia, keep an eye out, because I think those are two big moves that could definitely happen this summer for teams that are trying to push themselves up over the edge.
And for those of you wanting to keep tabs, earlier this week, Huddersfield did get a 1-1 draw with Chelsea FC, so they are officially safe. They were one of the teams that was battling out in the last week of relegation, in the Premier League. So Bobby Wood and his team in Germany, Hertha Berlin, not necessarily safe yet, but Huddersfield is safe, and potentially they'd be interested in Bobby Wood because it's an American to an American connection. Moving on, Dan. John Bush, longtime MLS goalkeeper, absolute legend as far as I'm concerned in the MLS 1.0 and MLS 2.0 era, has officially announced his retirement. He last played in MLS in 2015 with the Chicago Fire. Since then, he'd been with Indian 11 in the NASL, now a member of the USL as of 2018. First broke into MLS in terms of regular starting minutes with Columbus Crew back in 2002. Played for a number of years with the Chicago Fire. You'll remember him very fondly from his time with the San Jose Earthquakes. He was a member of that Goonies team in 2012 that won the Supporters Shield and then returned to the Fire in 2015. Bunch of records on the club, individual and overall league records in terms of games played, minutes played, shots saved, a whole bunch of other things. A really solid career in terms of an overall player and a really good guy in the heart of the MLS 2.0 era in Major League Soccer. Dan, he will sign a ceremonial one-day contract with Columbus Crew to retire with the team that gave him his first real opportunity to start. But just a solid guy, Dan. And I'm sure at some point, you know, an academy team or, you know, or an MLS team or somebody is going to call offering him an opportunity to coach or be involved in the academy or do some other thing in the community, no doubt. And he's going to take that and he's going to absolutely kill it. What are your fondest memories of John Bush as a keeper in Major League Soccer, Dan?
One of my fondest memories, I believe he, I can't remember where he flipped somebody off, but I do remember him flipping either a fan or flipping a ref off behind his back after something happened. Just overall, I mean, the personality behind John Bush was great, and he spent a lot of time in San Jose, and he was the main goalkeeper when I was still living in San Jose, or in the Bay, at least within Northern California. I never lived actually in the Bay Area, but when I was going to games as an Earthquakes fan and hanging out in the ultras, I mean, that was John Bush was the keeper then for me. An absolute legend, as you would say, all across the league. My favorite John Bush memory, though, was after, so it was the San Jose Earthquakes in 2014, after the World Cup, opened up their brand new, the San Francisco 49ers brand new stadium, Levi's Stadium. They played the first ever event there. I got a bunch of buddies hooked on soccer over the World Cup, and I took them to that game as Clint Dempsey and DeAndre Yedlin were coming to town. The San Jose Earthquakes got a 1-0 win in that game. It was an NBC Sports game. And so they had John Bush sitting at the desk with Stu Holden, and at the time it was Jim Cosimore who had done the play-by-play. So they had him sitting at the desk as they're doing their post game, and they had the desk right in front of the ultras on that, on the field sideline there. And the ultras, we were chanting at John Bush as he's being interviewed live on national television, our John Bush chant, which was "Some like it shaved, but we love Bush." And to see his face get red and to watch in the middle of live TV, Stu Holden, Jim Co, like all three of them just trying to keep it together, and then burst out laughing, and he comes up and, you know, shakes hands with everyone afterwards and, you know, squirts his water bottle in people's faces and stuff like that. It was just typical John Bush, a fun loving guy, a really great dude with a big heart for the community at large and for the game itself. And I will be really sad to see him go.
Absolutely, Dan. And for those of you who are new to Major League Soccer, I'd encourage you to go online. I believe Martin scored was what was ultimately a goal of the year candidate, or I think the winner of goal of the year, that resulted in what is fondly known as John Bushface, one of the better MLS 2.0 memes as far as I'm concerned. So go on, check that out, you know, on the internet, on Twitter, the video of the Obafemi Martins goal. Great goal. Great and absolutely surprised reaction from John Bush, and a really solid meme, if nothing else. Moving on, Dan, you were on location at Sporting Kansas City's training facility for their big news that they made earlier this week when Peter Vermees got a huge extension through the end of the 2023 MLS season as technical director and as head coach. What are your thoughts on that? Overall, what it means for Sporting Kansas City, for their investment in Peter Vermees, you know, as I would say borderline the Billy Beane of MLS 3.0 and et cetera, et cetera.
I think so. I mean, it's a huge double down. I believe, entirely believe in what Peter Vermees is doing. And I'll tell you why. It's because they, so every year they do a postseason meeting, and they kind of go over the plan for the future, what went right, what went wrong. They just kind of rehash everything that took place in 2018 or in the previous season. And then so leading into 2018, they were actually, according to the owner, Mike Gillig, they were trying to get it done before the season started, but Vermees was so involved and so busy in trying to get this retool done and getting guys like Johnny Russell and Johan Krause and Felipe Gutierrez into the team that they could never actually sit down and get the terms worked out. But, you know, Peter Vermees in that post-game press conference, or not post-game press conference, but in that post, the 2017 season review meeting, gave them and presented a 5-year plan for them to take everything up to the next level and what he wants to do over the next 5 years and stuff like that. And this was out of Vermees' mouth during the press conference. He said that the owner, Mike Gillig, came up to him on the flight, on a flight together, and he said that, you know, the only problem with that plan I have is the guy who just presented it to us isn't under contract for the full 5 years of that plan, and we'd like to make that happen. And Peter Vermees acts as his own agent, so it just began the tennis match of lobbing numbers back and forth at each other to extend the contract through 2023. And he had some things that he wanted in there that were that he felt needed to be a part of that contract. Vermees, the man, he's got three jobs. He's the technical director, he's the manager, and he's his own agent. Vermees, I think, is entirely deserved. His body of work and what he's been able to do and his own personal tactical evolution, as well as just the evolution of Sporting Kansas City and what they've been able to do. They're the most successful franchise in MLS over the last couple years. They have four trophies in 6 seasons. No other team is at that level in the last 6 years. So, you know, Vermees, since he's taken over, has just continued to take the team to new heights. And if he's still wanting to stick around and things aren't going bad, I don't see why not. And if he's got a big plan like he has, that he said, you know, their focus is to look more at their own backyard. And, you know, he feels like it would how amazing it would be to be able to put out a lineup at some point one day that has, you know, all 11 players came up through their academy and through Swope Park Rangers. And that's kind of a vision and a dream that he has as a way to build up soccer and keep the team sustainable by being able to create their own revenue through being able to sell off players, as well as their own player, like how many players they have and the talent that they have in their own system that they can supply without even having to pay the money to go, you know, deal with agent fees and deal with the transfer fee and get someone in. They're looking at this plan for the long term and how to keep themselves competitive and successful as MLS continues to evolve. I believe they liked it. So, you know, they're going to extend him. And I think it's a well-deserved extension for the man in charge here in Kansas City.
There's been a lot of talk about the, you know, the general manager position at U.S. Soccer, which is still open, and that puts that person ultimately being involved, if not straight out picking the head coach of the position. I think there's a lot of fans out there who would say Peter Vermees is one of the best candidates, at least amongst MLS circles, for either of those roles. There's been some reporting as to whether or not there's been contact or interest, or what that looks like in terms of Peter Vermees actually interviewing for either of those positions. What can you say, Dan, in terms of how this contract extension impacts Peter Vermees' potential candidacy for any position open in U.S. soccer throughout the life of his contract. Obviously, we know Bruce Arena still had a year left on his deal when he got in touch with U.S. soccer, and the LA Galaxy basically just said, we let him out of his contract, no financial needing to buy out whatsoever. What does this deal mean for Peter Vermees and any potential future opportunities pre-2023 with the U.S. Soccer Federation?
So yeah, the question was asked in the press conference whether he was unequivocally out of any running for any U.S. soccer position, and he still said no. He says, I really can't comment on it further because none of those opportunities have ever actually been put in front of me. So it sounds like maybe they have talked, but nothing has ever become ever serious between U.S. soccer and him. For the last couple of years, he said this as he's linked to it and, you know, potential interest. Would you be interested in the U.S. national team? And he goes, you know, I'm always going to pick up the phone if they call. And I think he believes that the job is an incredible job and something that, you know, would be an honorable job for him. But I think a fun quote that he said was that he's not a mercenary, that he's a builder, and he wants to, he doesn't want to spend, you know, a year here, 2 years there, a year there, and try and just find a winning situation and try and get out of that. He wants to build something that'll last long term over the course, and I think he's really, really dug into what he wants to do here at Sporting Kansas City. But I don't think he will ever truly rule himself out of it. But from all indications that I got from the press conference, even though he wouldn't talk on his contract, there is some way that U.S. soccer would be able to get him out of that contract. The only thing is the fact that they've never I don't even believe they've even discussed the potential of either of those roles. So I just don't see Vermees doing it. And while he won't fully rule himself out of it, I think for in the immediate future, I think it'd be pretty safe bet to rule him out of the running for the men's national team job, just because it seems like he's so dug into what he's doing at Sporting Kansas City, and the fact that, you know, he really wants to build this project long term to achieve whatever his ultimate vision and dream is for this franchise.
That does it for our rapid fire topics. Dan, it is time to move on to pick-ems. And we will start on Saturday. This will be on Univision at 3:30 p.m. Eastern. FC Dallas hosting the LA Galaxy. Both teams on kind of a meh run of form. The LA Galaxy are bad on the road, and they're back in Texas for the second week in a row. Dan, who you got and why?
FC Dallas, LA Galaxy are bad. They're on the road. They're bad. That's how it's going to go. I like FC Dallas. They've played a little bit better recently. I thought their draw was pretty meh. As you said, against LAFC over the weekend. But this is a lot worse team in LA Galaxy than LAFC. And I kind of like FC Dallas at home, for this one. It's a hot afternoon. Dallas used to training and dealing with that. I'm sure the Galaxy are as well, but there just seems to not be a whole lot of good things going the Galaxy's way right now, and the FC Dallas have at least been in better form than the Galaxy. So I'll take a boring, terrible 1-0 win for FC Dallas.
You took everything that I was literally going to say. I was going to say this boring 1-0 game that you will ever see whatsoever. I agree with you, Dan. Dallas is at home. Dallas plays great at home. Galaxy are still figuring things out. I wouldn't even bother watching this one, folks, if it wasn't on Spanish and you didn't get to listen to it in the amazing Univision Spanish broadcast. Moving on, folks, we'll be doing the three Sunday games, all on national television. First, we'll start off at 4 p.m. Eastern. Portland Timbers hosting Seattle Sounders FC in the first Cascadia Cup clash of the season. This will be on ESPN. Dan, who you got and why? Keeping in mind, Sounders did have to play midweek at Toronto.
I'm actually going to go with Portland. They're on the hot run of form. They've won three in a row. Seattle are, like you said, are coming off a game at the midweek. And I don't really like, overall, even despite the win in Toronto, I just don't like Seattle Sounders' run of form currently. And Portland are hot. They're at home. It just doesn't seem right for this Sounders team. So I'm going to go 2-0 to the Timbers.
This game is tailor-made for a Diego Valeri ball out, so to speak. You know, Seattle Sounders having to play midweek, having to fly all the way across the country and all the way back. I agree with you, tailor-made for the Portland Timbers. I'm going to say 2-1, an absolute second half barn burner. Moving on, this will be at 6 p.m. Eastern, folks. Orlando City SC hosting Atlanta United FC on FS1. Dan, I don't know if this has a name because these are the two, like, southeastern corner teams in MLS, so to speak. But in any case, these two teams playing, always an exciting clash from an attacking standpoint. Atlanta lost midweek. Who you got and why?
I am going to go with a Orlando City. Actually, no, I can't do that. I'm going to go with a crazy 3-3 draw in this, just because, while Atlanta have showed that they've been able to play midweek and go and get a result on the weekend, I don't think that they have a problem with that. I know it's on the road against Orlando City, but, you know, that offense is good. They're high-powered. They're going to have everyone in that attack back and playing, and especially in the midfield and actually the back line. The only difference there is that they don't have Brad Guzan. I think with the way Orlando City has been playing in terms of scoring goals recently, I think they're going to give some troubles to Christensen, their keeper, their backup fourth string keeper there, that'll be playing for them, as both Mitch Hildebrand is injured, I believe, and so is Alec Kahn, the former Sporting KC keeper. So we're on to the 70th overall draft pick of the 2018 MLS draft in Mr. Christensen, out of University of Portland, who made his full debut, made one save, but just got beat by two really good goals there from Sporting Kansas City. I just feel like this is a wild barn burner of a draw. Atlanta are on the road, yes, but they still have good firepower. Orlando City have firepower against a bad goalkeeper. I'm going to go with crazy 3-3 draw.
Orlando is on, I believe, a 6-game winning streak now, but all things come to an end, and I think it will come to on Sunday at Orlando City Stadium. Dan, I think Atlanta will be absolutely hopping mad that they did not get the win against Sporting midweek. I think they would argue that they should have had a goal in the first 20 minutes with all the chances that they got. Some of them might be saying that Brad Guzan shouldn't have gotten a red card, and if he wasn't red carded, Atlanta would have gotten out there with a win. I think they absolutely bounce back and they get a 2-1 win over Orlando City's defense, who are basically shredded cheese, and when you give that much space to Miguel Amarone and Joseph Martinez, bad things are going to happen for you defensively. 2-1 to the Five Stripes. And then lastly, folks, this will be the evening cap on Sunday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern on FS1, LAFC hosting NYCFC in a cross-country matchup. Dan, who you got and why? New York City FC did lose pretty poorly to New York Red Bulls in the Hudson River Derby, but LAFC had to play midweek.
Yeah, LAFC have to travel across country to play on a postage stamp. So I'm going to go with New York. Oh, no, never mind. Sorry, switch that around. They do play host. I completely read that wrong. Never mind. But still, New York City FC have been a good team on the road. They came up against it, against New York Red Bulls. Every single time that they've had a bad loss, though, this New York City FC team has come back out and put out a statement win. That loss against FC Dallas that you remember, that was a bad loss, and then they come back and smack someone the next Sunday. Or no, the loss against Portland, and they came back and smacked FC Dallas. I think the same thing will happen here. LAFC on tired legs from a midweek game. I know New York City have to travel across, but I haven't entirely been impressed with what LAFC has done in recent games. Although I did think they were put out a better performance against Minnesota. But this New York City FC team is a completely different animal than Minnesota United. If they play anything close to what they did against Minnesota United, I think they'd wind up with a loss. They're going to have to play really good, and really strong and resolute and mistake-free. And I don't know if I can expect that out of the current LAFC, especially against a team like New York City FC, who have a chip on their shoulder to get another win back. So I'm going to go New York City FC with the road win against LAFC. I'm going to go 2-1 in favor of the Sky Blue.
I'm going to go with a 3-3 barn burner draw here, Dan, just because MLS, and you can't argue against me on that. That does it for us with all of our main content. Dan, time for last words. We're going to be find you on the Twitter machines, and do you have any last words?
No last words is all, or yeah, no actual last words this week. You can find me, though, on Twitter, at SperryDaniel94. Decent amount of soccer, smattering of baseball. Have a lot of fun on that. On that account. So come and hang out with me and watch some soccer this weekend.
Absolutely. Listeners, you can follow me individually. LWS map. Check out all of our written audio and video work at lastwordonsoccer.com or across all social media platforms at lastwordsc. Dan, I'm super excited because I just found out one of my favorite St. Louis soccer personalities, Matt Bird, at Luligan Bird on Twitter, is actually going to be in town when St. Louis FC takes on Colorado Springs Switchbacks. He'll be here with his son, Ewan, which I'm really, really excited for, and that will be in a couple weeks, I believe on the 26th of May, the same day as the Champions League final. So me and a couple of other Rapids friends will be will be on location for both one of the bars down there in the Springs to watch Champions League final, and we will also be there to check out St. Louis FC taking on the Switchbacks. So I'm super excited about that. We'll be missing Colorado Rapids taking on Portland Timbers, unfortunately. Lastly, folks, thank you to our sponsors, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of MLS, the USL, and US Soccer. Get your custom scarves for your group, team, or yourself individually at roughneckscarves.com. That does it for us, folks. Enjoy your Super Soccer weekend. Enjoy Championship Sunday over in the Premier League and all other things that are going on, MLS related or otherwise. We'll check you next week.